Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Western media, pundits, and politicians refuse to say the quiet part out loud. The conflict in Ukraine actually has little to do with Ukraine itself. This conflict is a united Western front against Russia. This means when the war is over, it will be on Moscow's terms and timetable. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by guests here in Moscow, Dmitry Suslov. He's the deputy director of the Center for Comprehensive European and International Studies at the Higher School of Economics. And we have Xavier Moreau. He is the founder of the Center of Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with Dmitry. Dmitry, I mean, I find it really curious over the last couple of news cycles, we have the Ukrainian prime minister saying the war, they're winning the war and they will win the war and it will be over soon. And then you have one of the biggest cheerleaders of this conflict, a country within NATO, the British prime minister, Boris Johnson, admitting publicly in front of media that Ukraine is most likely going to lose this war here. So, I mean, can you kind of square the circle for me here? Because it begs the question, if the British prime minister doesn't think this war is going to be won on terms that he finds acceptable, then why are they even pursuing it? Because isn't this fighting a war to the last Ukrainian? Your thoughts?
Well, first, I fully agree that the desire, the intention of the West is really to fight this war until the last Ukrainian, because this war is indeed not about Ukraine. This war is about getting Russia out from the position of a great power and thus restoring the leadership of the United States and of the collective West. The war has already contributed to consolidation of the West and restoration of American dominance in Europe in a way which was unprecedented over the last, 30 years. And it is really about American leadership. It is really about such an international order in which the United States would restore its position as a global leader. Thus, whether Ukraine is defeated, you know, in the near term future or in the longer term future, how many Ukrainians die, it really doesn't matter. The purpose is to exhaust Russia militarily, economically, undermine it politically. Thus, the West is interested in this war going on as long as possible. Right? It is very, I think, important that we have not heard any direct and explicit word from the United States that they support a peace agreement, that they want the peace agreement to happen as soon as possible. You know, there were some speculations about that, let's say, from Paris. Macron told that he supports the peace agreement. Also, of course, Erdogan and you know, the leaders who maintain ties with Russia, China, India, they all claim that they want a peace agreement as soon as possible, but not from the United States and the major allies of the United States, because their interest is directly opposite. Their interest is endless continuation of this war, Afghanization of Ukraine. Thus, we face an increase of the supplies of heavy weapons. Thus, we face constant pressure all over the world for the countries to reduce their cooperation with Russia, and we face the further increase of sanctions.
Yeah, well, you know, Xavier, it was interesting. The Ukrainian President Zelensky a couple of days ago said that. Well, I guess he can make demands right now. He wants the West to pay Ukraine civil servants' salaries $7 billion a month or something like that. Who wouldn't want that war to keep going on? I mean, that sounds like a really good grift here. But on a more serious note, well, I think it's kind of counterintuitive. When you think about it, because we have the Ukrainian side saying vis-a-vis Mariupol, you know, if Mariupol falls, we will not be in negotiations with the Russians. If this happens, we won't be in negotiations. If this happens, you know, the same story over and over again. Kind of reminds me of December, January, and February when the Russians were trying to communicate with the West. But the refusal on the part of the Ukrainians to negotiate with the Russians basically, as I said in my introduction, it really allows Russia to determine when the war is over and under what terms. I mean, they're not, again, you know, the West is using Ukraine as a fulcrum to get at Russia. And even the Ukrainians have kind of, you know, walked away from their own agency by not being engaged in some kind of negotiation. Presumably, it would be in their interest. Go ahead, Xavier.
Actually, you know, because of the stubborn of Zelensky and the West, situation for Ukraine as a state will be worse. For instance, months ago, the war aims from Russia was clear. It was denazification, demilitarization, and from the Ukrainian side, recognize the Crimea and the independence of the both republic. But 2 days ago, it has changed already. So now Russia openly said that they will take control of the source part of the of Ukraine. So now the Russia is clearly talking about creating Novorossiya, the worst nightmare for the West. And it will be worse if Zelensky and the West can't understand the current situation. And something is very interesting as well. And I saw it on the French channel that they explained us during almost 2 months that the Russian army destroyed and that Putin wanted to finish before the 9th of May. And he couldn't do it. And Putin never said, neither Putin nor the Ministry of defense never said that they want to finish on the 9th of May. And now what it explains that, yes, of course, you destroy our army, but we are going to take the south of Ukraine. And if you continue, what it means, so the first proposal was refused. So this is the second one. It's worse than the first. And if you don't understand the words, so we will take both side of the Dnieper. That's the result of this stubborn politic from the West, from NATO. Because of course it's not a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's a war between Russia and NATO in Ukraine. That's exactly what happened now.
Dmitry, the way I look at this here is that this is a at least from the Ukrainian Western side. This is just one really massive propaganda campaign because the West wants a propaganda victory because a military one is simply not in the cards. And that's what makes it very asymmetrical. One of the things I find very curious, and I'd like to know what both of you think, why should we assume that these armchair generals in the West that haven't won wars for 30 years, they understand Russia's war aims? Okay, other than denazification and demilitarization, both can, you know, you can look very deeply into those. But it's in those two goals were very intentional. They don't really show very much. So well, I have always said to people, and I get a lot of pushback, obviously, is that since we don't know what the end game, what the Russian side has in mind for Ukraine, you cannot really understand the process of the military campaign itself. If you don't understand the end game, you can't understand the start and the middle part of the game. Go ahead, Dmitry.
Well, first, I think that no matter how much weapons the West provides to Ukraine, it will not be able to radically shift the balance of power. It is simply impossible. And there is no way for Ukraine, even with all the Western support, military, you know, intelligence sharing and so on and so forth, to win this war. It's just impossible, and this makes the Western position so cynical, because they understand that Ukraine is doomed for failure, either sooner or later, but it is doomed for failure. And they are just extending this agony and deliberately allow more people on both sides to die. And more civilians even to suffer, because of course they also bear the cost of the hostilities. But I fully agree on the propaganda side. Indeed, the informational dominance in the global media is one of the very few instruments of power which is almost fully possessed by the West still. You know, they are losing military. They have already lost military dominance. They are losing financial dominance because the era of the dollar domination as the global reserve currency and exchange currency is ending right now. They are also losing political dominance because the overwhelming majority of the non-Western countries, including such great as China, India, Brazil, Middle Eastern countries, Latin American countries, did not join sanctions, and they are actually strengthening their relations with Russia, not decreasing them. So the only instrument which is still in almost full possession of the West is information, creating these narratives in the global media, and they are doing that. And I agree, you know, the narratives that they create have nothing to do with reality, because I remember that they defined the original Russian endgame as complete occupation of Ukraine. You know, no one was talking about that, but
Kiev was supposed to fall in 24 hours and all that. You know, exactly. I mean, I find it really astounding. If we look at Afghanistan, we look at Iraq, we look at Syria, how these people can even show their face in public, okay? Look at the fall of Kabul. Everything was fine in Afghanistan until it wasn't, okay? And these same people are talking about what Russia's military aims are. I mean, I've never understood why any kind of occupation of Kiev would be necessary at all, okay?
Absolutely. And now Joe Biden says, you know, we will not allow Russia to occupy the whole of Ukraine. Come on, who has ever said about the Russian intention to occupy Ukraine, especially provided, I mean, even the very limited number of troops that Russia is using in the in Ukraine conflict.
Very limited, okay? But oh no, but there are shortages and they're asking China for help.
It's just, yeah.
You know, actually, what did Russia? They started an operation in four directions. They observed and they saw that in three directions, things going very well and very quick, very fast. So they decided to concentrate the forces in the place where it's the most easier. It's usual. It's nothing surprising. It doesn't mean that they don't want to. There is a failure in the north of Ukraine. It's completely different. But you see the difference between the Ukrainian forces and the Russian forces is that the Ukrainian forces are led by a communication team. That's the reason why they sacrifice the troops in Mariupol. They refuse to evacuate them to fight in another line. Okay, this is what as a military they should have done. But in Russia, it's exactly the contrary.
Hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with me. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the Home Edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Xavier here in Moscow. We were talking about how Russia is pursuing its operation in Ukraine, and we had to go to a break. So finish up. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, just I would like to tell that the team leading the Ukrainian forces are the communication team. That's the reason why they sacrificed troops in Mariupol when they were able to move them to the west to fight again. But they don't want to lose Mariupol. Exactly. I'm not comparing Hitler with Zelensky, okay? It's just for, a point of view of operation. Exactly as the same that Hitler refused to move the German troop in the Baltic countries, because he said, but if we move the from the Baltic countries, it means that we lost the war. And so the result, the Russians go to Berlin, and the German troops couldn't fight anymore till the end of the war. So it's exactly the same. On the contrary, for the Russian forces, this is the military who leads the operations. And you saw that, for instance, in Kiev. Of course, on a communication point of view, it was a failure for Russia, because Kiev could pretend that they start a counteroffensive and that's all. But actually, Vladimir Putin doesn't care of that. He gives the lead to the military. And so they took the forces to bring them to the The main operation is the east of Ukraine for two reasons. First, of course, it's the question of liberating Donbas. And the second point is because the army, the Ukrainian army, were about to invade Donbas, is all concentrated on this at this place. And again, Zelensky and, of course, his sponsors, they doesn't want to move the Ukrainian army, to move them to the west, to try to build a new line of defense. They will let them till the end in Severodonetsk, in Lysychansk, in Slavyansk, because they don't want to lose the communication war. But on the Russian side, they don't care of losing the communication war when they will be in Dnipropetrovsk and or in Odessa.
That's such a good point, Xavier. Let me go back to Dmitry here. I mean, you know, obviously it's my job to cover Western media on this topic. And I've been, you know, unlike Western media, I've been covering this ever since the coup on the Maidan in 2014. And so the context is very real and meaningful to me and is obviously for both of you here. But there's very little commentary about who has influence of the in the regime in Kiev. We have these Azov group, we have Pravi Sektor, we have a really malign groups of people that they're turned into freedom fighters, which in fact they are not. Okay, and the intelligence service, the SUB, even before the military conflict started on February 24th of this year, there was scathing criticism of their behavior as a secret police, very much along the lines of the Stasi in East Germany. Please tell us a little bit more about that, because that's really a black hole in the coverage of this conflict.
Well, Peter, I've already discussed the issue of the West creating narratives which have very little with the reality, and the narrative of a democratic government in Ukraine is precisely one of them. You know, because first, again, Joe Biden is widely talking about the democratically elected government in Ukraine. Here we have to bear in mind that the current regime in Ukraine emerged as a result of a military coup, as a bloody coup, right? So, physically Zelensky was elected, but the whole regime came to power not as a result, not through a democratic process. And secondly, especially already before the beginning of the Russian special operation, but especially during, we've been witnessing a very rapid transformation of this current regime in Kyiv towards a staunch dictatorship. I would say comparable to dictatorships in Central Asia in the previous decades, not even today, because what we are viewing is political parties being abolished and persecuted, political rivals being put into prison, and maybe beaten, tortured, and persecuted, right? All the opposition is being burned down completely. Both among the political elites and in the society, who does not share the mainstream is being interrogated and persecuted, right? And people are in danger, right? They can no longer express.
What I also have to point out, Dmitry, is that all media has been virtually all media has been nationalized.
Absolutely. So there is no freedom of speech in the part of Ukraine which is under the control of the Kyiv regime right now. And this is the reality which is completely missed by the West, who continue to create a picture of the struggle, you know, between good and bad, between so-called authoritarian Russia and so-called democratic Ukraine. You know, in fact, it does not match the reality at all.
You know, Xavier.
Yes, I would like to add that there is two main opponents to Zelensky. The first one is Medvedchuk. He is in jail. The second one is Anatoly Shari. He's in exile in Spain. And actually, he didn't start because of the war, because a year ago already, Zelensky closed three TV channels because they were supposed to be pro-Russian channel, and they were supposed to belong to Medvedchuk. And actually, he took sanctions against his own citizen. So now the Kiev regime is a regime when you can send people to jail, you can take the assets without any court, just taking the decision from the, because the prince decided, and the prince now is Zelensky. So of course it's not a democracy. It's just a dictator, a totalitarian country. Because of course when you, if you not agree, you will be interrogated. And what is very interesting is what happens now in the south of Ukraine, where the region where the Russian took immediately the control, Kherson region, and two-thirds of the Zaporozhye region. Now there is a military civilian administration from the Russian side. And people are very happy using ruble. They can again speak Russian in the street, in the school, in the university, without being threatened, without getting penalties. So in my opinion, is that the Russian need to do? And I would like another example, if you allow me. You know, the city of Kupiansk, it's about 130 kilometers in the east of Kharkov, was immediately taken by the Russian because the local mayor say, okay, don't destroy anything, we will cooperate with you. And what did the SBU? They kidnapped her daughter, his daughter, and they threatened him. And so he had to make a public speech, and you can find it easily on the internet, saying that he Zelensky is responsible for what will happen to his daughter. So this is the level we are now. Look at the Medvedchuk when he was shown by the SBU. He was kidnapped, I think, maybe 3 weeks ago, and it's clearly that the condition where he lives now are very hard for him. And it's even a shame showing the main, again, is the main Zelensky's opponent. Look at him. It's a symbol of what the Kievsky regime is now.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all part of the narratives that Dmitry has mentioned on this program already. Another narrative that is actually, again, very counterintuitive. So the West sanctions Russia, sanctioned like no other country. And we've talked about sanctions on Iran and North Korea, but Russia is under a sanction here. But, you know, everything that goes wrong in the West, immigration, inflation, supply chains, and it's also the Russians. So you sanction it, you cause all these problems for your own people, and then you say, but it's the Russians' fault. It's what it's the Putin price hike, as I like to call it here. I mean, again, it's really, this is really just a propaganda campaign, because if you get down to it, okay, so you want to cut off Russian energy. So you take that energy off the market, the price goes up, the Russians make more money from, I mean, I don't know who's thinking about these ideas, because the more they push, the more they hurt themselves. And they're having a very difficult time, because I think personally, there's going to be a lot of social unrest in the West because of this. And these sanctions, no matter what happens, are not going to go away anytime soon. Dmitry.
Well, I think that this process of social unrest has already started, you know, because the inflation in both Europe and the United States is unprecedented for the last three decades. And it's going to be worse, not better. Of course, the more sanctions does the West apply, the worse is the domestic condition, but also the worse is the state of the global economy. You know, what strikes me is, for instance, the latest statement by the ministers of finance of the G7, which was adopted last week, claims very ridiculously that the sanctions against Russia were designed in a way that they are very targeted and they are not hurting the global economy. I mean, this is just a staunch lie from A to Z, because precisely the anti-Russian sanctions and the resultative increase of the oil price is the major reason behind the increase of the price for food. You know, because we started that at the Higher School of Economics, and over the last 50 years, there is absolute dependence, direct absolute dependence between the price of oil and the price for food. You know, they just follow in every
social unrest. And yeah. Social unrest.
And social unrest, of course. And the problem of food, you know, the food deficit, the price for food would result into famine. In the third world, in Africa. And again, already now, the G7 countries are trying to put the blame on Russia, whereas in fact they bear the responsibility because it is their attempts to establish the oil embargo on Russia, which results into the price hike, right? And thus creates huge... I'd like to
finish on this. We just the reports coming out of the UK now that the upcoming winter, if things remain the same, is that there are going to be extreme fuel insecurity for the average Briton. Who would have thought that for a G7, G20 country? But that's where we are, gentlemen. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests here in Moscow. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.